Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama announced $8 billion in high-speed rail projects last week. We'll look this hour at what that means, what it doesn't, and where it puts the U.S. in the global high-speed rail picture. High speed can just mean faster than slow, like 80 miles an hour now from Boston to Washington. Or it can mean 200 plus miles an hour in China, where they're spending $300 billion for 16,000 miles of track. This hour on Point, high speed rail, what it means and what's coming here and around the world. You can join the conversation. Have you sped across Europe or Asia on high speed rail lines? Have you wished you could do that here in the U.S.? Do you think you will? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Robert Puentes, senior fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. He's been closely following the push for high-speed rail in the United States. Robert Puentes, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Paris in France, Ignacio Barón, high-speed director at the International Union of Railroads. He will be traveling to Washington, Chicago, and Los Angeles next week with rail experts from Asia and Europe to meet with high-speed rail planners in the United States. Monsieur Barón, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Thanks.
It's great to have you. Robert, if I may come first to you just for a little definition. We began to talk about the range, but what is high-speed rail? What does it mean? What's the range in terms of speed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that's a question a lot of folks have been asking these last couple of weeks. I think that when these grants were announced in connection with the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act last year, there was this idea that we were going to have these gleaming kind of bullet trains shooting all across the country within relatively short order. But as the realities, you know, have set in about just how much this nation needs to invest, you know, given the condition of the rail system today, I think that the expectations that folks have been lowered. I think that what we're trying to do now is to at least make sure that our metropolitan areas, which are the engines of our national economy, are connected through some kind of passenger service for trains. So the words high speed are still kind of part of this conversation, but I think what we're talking about now, and probably appropriately so, is just quality, efficient passenger rail service, and that's an incremental step before we get to something that's truly, truly high speed.
Quality and efficiency sound great, but they don't sound like blow your hair back speed. Ignacio Barón in Paris, if you can do it in miles per hour for us, if you'd be good enough, around the world, what is the range? What are top speeds that are used in significant passenger, you know, high-speed rail lines? What's the range and where?
Well, normally we consider that high speed starts at 125 miles per hour, so it's 200 kilometers per hour. Mm-hmm. But normally, but this is the limit from the technical point of view, this is the limit of classic rails. When you upgrade the line and you introduce new trains, you can arrive up to about 200 kilometers per hour, 125 miles per hour. But usually high speed starts at 250 kilometers per hour. That means 155 miles per hour, and this is the common minimum high speed considering in Europe, in France, in Spain, in Italy, in Germany, and in Japan, in Korea, in China, Taiwan, all the countries including high speed in Europe and Asia.
And we're looking here at the new Beijing to Shanghai line. That's quite a distance, approaching 220 miles an hour, the top speed.
Sure. It is expected, as well as the new lines recently opened in China in the last week. Just they opened a new line of 500 kilometers, operating at 350 kilometers per hour. That means at 220 miles per hour. And they have already about, I speak in kilometers, but it's about 2,000 kilometers, so about 1,250 miles of a new high-speed line in operation at 220 miles per hour of maximum speed. Mm. And this is really impressive because of the level of traffic, not only the maximum speed, but also the frequency. The trains very often at the 3, 4, 5 minutes of frequency. So the capacity is one of the characteristics of this new and modern transport system. Mm. And this is very important for Chinese.
Robert Puentes, of course, you've got a very different picture there. The Communist Party can kind of just lay down a line on a map and bulldoze everything in its path, and they are doing that. I mean, they are building at unbelievable speed, like 100,000 laborers at a time on single line. They're going to spend $300 billion for 16,000 miles of high-speed rail by 2020. That's on a different scale. It really puts that $8 billion announcement last week in some kind of context in a hurry.
Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt. I mean, the good thing about looking at what China is doing is that it really is kind of aspirational. I think it gets people very enthusiastic, and you look at these bold investments, these transformative investments that they're making in their economy, and that it gets people here in the U.S. very excited. But you're right. We're not China, and there's a lot of things that they can do there that we simply can't do here. As a federalist republic, I mean, the contrasts are so stark. But, you know, there are other examples. You know, we look over in Europe. I mean, Germany is a federalist republic. They have their state, their Länders, and they have a relationship between the federal government and these entities. And they have built, as was mentioned, you know, very extensive, very efficient, I think very enviable network over there. So, you know, China may not be the right place to look for those for a blueprint, right, for how we're going to do this. But there are a lot of other examples. I think Europe is a good place to start.
Talk to us about what is on the drawing board in the U.S. at the high end of what's planning. Yes, there's just to sort of fix up the gravel and the track and, you know, get things back in working order. But when it comes to something like high speed, where are the most, I don't know, shining, if that's the right word, projects emerging? We know Tampa-Orlando, for starter. What's that going to look like?
That's the one that I got the most attention, given that the president mentioned that specifically at the State of the Union address,
yeah.
And actually went down there to make the announcement the day after the State of the Union. I think that is probably the one example where we do think this is going to reach some kind of high speed. It was 160 miles an hour, maybe a little bit, give or take, something around there. This is a new line that they're putting down. It is a public-private partnership. The state has been doing a lot of work to get something put in place down there for some time.
This is like $1 billion-plus dollars, 80-plus miles, essentially from the coast inland, and ultimately would go on to Miami?
Indeed. It's 1.25 now from Tampa to Orlando, and
billion.
Then the plan is to connect it, yes, down to Miami at some point. But as you mentioned, this is $8 billion for the entire nation, for a nation that has really neglected this investment for so long. You know, $8 billion used to sound like a lot of money, but it's just not that much for what we want to do here. So having these high-profile projects like Florida, the California project, the high-speed rail initiative up there.
That's a pretty big one. I mean, there's a couple billion dollars toward it out of the $8 billion, and ultimately maybe $40-plus billion will be spent on a line all the way from San Francisco down to L.A. and beyond, 220 miles per hour, we're told.
Yeah, down to San Diego. So it is the whole state. And they've been at this for a long time, as has Florida, as has the Midwest. So I think the places where you're seeing some of these initial tranches of investment are in those places that have had many years of kind of laying the groundwork, if you will, for these kinds of investments. So those are the places, I think, where we're going to see some of the best bang for the buck in the short term.
We'll look across the country at what else is on the drawing board now with some money behind it. Here's President Obama in his State of the Union address just a week ago talking about the new high-speed push.
Workers will soon break ground on a new high-speed railroad funded by the Recovery Act. There are projects like that all across this country that will create jobs and help move our nation's goods, services, and information.
Here he is, the president saying, let's do it. Let's get our callers in here. Jennifer in Charleston, South Carolina. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I just wanted to comment. I did have the luxury of traveling by high-speed rail through Europe, and as a U.S. citizen came back here just feeling slightly disappointed that we don't have that availability to see our beautiful country here as they do in Europe.
What, because we don't have the same quality of rail line? I mean, you can drive the interstate here, I guess, Jennifer.
You could drive the interstate, yes, but it's a little bit more tasking. More is involved, and it's a little bit more dangerous, and
yes.
It's not... Being able to travel by rail, it affords a certain kind of leisure to your travels, as opposed to here, it's a little more stressful, there's more elements involved. It's not just easy to pack up your bags and go for a long weekend down to Florida from Charleston if I wanted to.
And if we had high-speed rail in the U.S., would you do it ahead of car or ahead of air travel?
Absolutely. Absolutely, 100%.
There's a vote for it, and bring it on. Thanks, Jennifer. Let's go to Greg in Derry, New Hampshire. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm actually, it's interesting. I moved to New Hampshire, and I work in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very disappointing for me to see that a lot of the stimulus money that came to the States was and is being used on widening our highways, repaving roads that to me seem like they're fine, when I would love to get on a train in New Hampshire and sit on it for 45 minutes to an hour and get into Boston and go to my job every day instead of sitting in a car. And I'm wondering, was it the states that failed? Was it the federal government that failed with this initial batch of money that went to the states? Did they just fail to put it to good use?
Greg, let us pick it up. Robert Puentes, I mean, I guess what we're seeing is what's there. It's $8 billion for rail and not more. Greg would like more, but there's a lobby for and need for highway repairs too, I guess.
There certainly is. I think that what we saw, again, a year ago, I mean, we were facing economic, we were on the precipice of economic collapse,
yep,
right, and all that. So there was this real serious push for getting money out the door as quickly as possible, right? So in this country, the things that were on the shelf, you know, being built or not, were these kind of mundane gray infrastructure projects, as the caller mentioned, you know, repavings, pothole fixes, bridge repair. I mean, some of these things that have been on the books for a lot of years for lots of different reasons, but these were the things that were ready to go. And I think what happened is then they got ready to finalize the recovery package. They realized that the promises that were being made from the presidential campaign just before it, from both sides, were that we were going to have this clean, green recovery, but that wasn't congruous with this gray infrastructure. So this $8 billion kind of came in as something that was aspirational, something transformative.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about high-speed rail all over the world and the new U.S. push to join the game. Let's hear a little bit of people that have been celebrating for a while. Now, here's a Reuters report about the opening of the Beijing-Tianjin high-speed rail line in time for the 2008 Olympics in China.
The railway will be the fastest that will officially open on Friday in time for the Beijing Olympics, which begin on August 8th and will shuttle people to soccer events in Tianjin, one of the game's co-host cities.
Couple hundred miles an hour, top speed there. Everybody's building them. Look at a map of the world, and they are, especially in Europe and Asia, all over. Here's President Obama talking about development in Florida. Tampa last week announcing some of the winners, the $8 billion in high-speed rail stimulus spending.
We want to start looking deep into the 21st century. And we want to say to ourselves, there is no reason why other countries can build high-speed rail lines and we can't. And that's what's about to happen right here in Tampa. We are going to start building a new high-speed rail line.
It's exciting. You can hear it. It comes with jobs. But deep into the 21st century, well, it's happening all over. Here's a report from September last year on the future of high-speed train travel in Spain.
The government here boasts that by the end of next year, Spain will have the most extensive network of high-speed rail in the world, overtaking Japan and France. And it says that by 2020, 9 out of 10 Spaniards will have a high-speed rail station within 30 miles of their home.
High-speed rail within 30 miles of their home in Spain, 9 out of 10 people. That sounds pretty appealing. Robert Puentes is with us from the Brookings Institution. And from Paris, Ignacio Barón is here, high-speed director at the International Union of Railroads, watching the whole picture around the world. You can join the conversation, 800-423-TALK. Ignacio Barón, in Paris, when you look at the United States, does it look like a good candidate for high-speed rail? Or is the country too big? You know, is there too much built infrastructure in the way already? Is it too, for some reason, not hospitable for high-speed rail broadly?
Well, in the United States, I think we can compare the case of USA with the entire Europe. It's not a country, but it's a continent.
Mm-hmm.
As well as in Europe, we started by a first line from Paris to Lyon in 1981, and then other lines followed step by step. One entire network is not possible to build in just a few months, with maybe with the exception of China, because it's a very particular case. and they have very strong problems of capacity, and they need to solve these problems urgently. But normally, and then the financial system of Chinese is different from the rest of the world. But I think this is, you have repeated several times, the message from President Obama, I think, is much more important than the people believe, because mm-hmm. it is not just to implement a new transport system or a new investment or a new potential, something good for the environment. It's changing the style of life, because it's not only high speed. When you speak about high speed, you speak about the stations, you speak about mass transit, urban transport in combination with high-speed trains. So it is really something very, very important, because it's changing the style of life, the style of transport. And this is, I think, is very, very important, and we will see this effect in the coming years. And concerning investments, everybody speaks about $8 billion, but I think $8 billion is just a start. In fact, the investment is very high, but also, as well as the rest of investment you can make in the life, investment is to recuperate this investment with a benefit. And in this case, this investment, important investment from the president of USA, mm-hmm. is to be recuperated by obtaining an important benefit for society. And I think this is very important to consider. It's not just the money which is to put on the table for this ambitious project, but it's also that what the society, American society, will recuper from this investment.
Robert Puentes, how about it? How do you see the main benefits of high-speed rail? Is it convenience, comfort? Is it environmental benefits? What's the, how do the benefits add up here?
Yeah, I think it's exactly right. These investments are part of a signal, I think, to a transition to a new economy, right? So if the new economy is going to be low carbon and innovation fueled, and there are certain investments that we have to make. And the president has talked about moving away from the kind of investments that we used to make before that were maybe more appropriate for past decades, and new kind of investments for the future. So there's going to be mistakes along the way, and there's going to be a learning curve that we're going to have to get over. But I think that these are the kind of investments that folks feel like America needs to make if we're going to compete in the 21st century. If we're going to, as the caller kind of mentioned, if we're going to be in Europe and you're going to see the kind of investments that they have, and then you get back to America and you wonder which is the world global powerhouse. So I think the impressions and the signals are certainly important. But if we are facing this carbon-constrained future, investments in things like high-speed rail and moving away from diesel engines are going to be important as well.
So is there a real carbon savings with high-speed rail? How big is it? I read 30% somewhere. I mean, it's not the sun and the moon. 30% is a lot, but it's not like zero emissions when you're using high-speed rail.
No, and in fact, some of the investments that are being made that are part of this package now are still in those old diesel engines. So again, as was mentioned, this is mm-hmm. incremental. We're going to have to start moving away. And there's probably no better time now than to start moving us to this new kind of green, clean future.
So Tampa, Orlando, and California, they're talking about with this new $2.25 billion, they might start construction on the, 500 or 600 mile route through the Central Valley in 3 years. What about the rest of the country? There's on the map of here of what's on the drawing board. There's a lot of squiggles between Kansas City and Chicago, Detroit, Milwaukee. What and when there, Robert Puentes?
Well, again, I think that the Midwest group, and they've had a coalition up there that's been in place for some time, and so they've done a lot more of the work that I think is needed. I think Chicago, clearly, as a historic rail hub, is going to be the center of this. They've got ideas for lines that are going up through Wisconsin, up into Minneapolis, down to St. Louis. Amtrak actually owns some track in parts of Michigan, so maybe extending it into Detroit. There's lots of ideas and lots of corridors, I think, that are perfect candidates for these. But the key thing about these investments is that we have to get these initial ones right. I still think that $8 billion is a lot of money, but it's not going to have this transformative effect if this is all we're going to get. So there's $2.5 billion that the president put into the FY 2010 budget. He just asked for another $1 billion for high-speed rail yesterday in the 2011 budget. If this is all the investments that we're going to make, then we're going to fall short, I think, of that transformative future that I think people have in mind. It's going to have to be just one of the first kind of investments that we need to make. So these initial investments have to be those that have the best bang for the buck, and we have to get these right.
The map, the drawing board, shows a lot of ambitions waiting to be filled. I mean, Cincinnati, Dayton up to Cleveland, Charlotte to Raleigh, up to Richmond and Washington, D.C. And then, of course, there's a whole Northeast and the idea of some going into upstate New York. Let's hear from our listeners, Linda in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Linda, you're on the air.
Hello. I've been working in China since 1980, and there's quite a difference in attitude and planning between the United States and China and what they're up to.
Mm-hmm.
To their advantage, I suppose you could call it, they have a clean slate because they didn't have any really serious transportation infrastructure at all until very recently. They've only been at this for 30 years.
But you call it a clean slate, but that's partly because they're willing to bulldoze right through neighborhoods and just do it.
Well, I think that's in the cities, but the major problem from there is distance. Now, China is now building its first ever highway. China has never had a highway until now, and it's going up now, and they're copying the United States Eisenhower system,
mm-hmm.
even the plans. That is for freight. The emphasis on the rail system is for passenger traffic. Because traditionally, Chinese have traveled, as you probably know, for New Year's, everybody moves. And that's what they're looking at, is peak loading there. But the comparison might be made usefully with India, where China is going to dominate substantially. And India has nominal rail track, but it's in terrible condition.
So people are talking about something being built there as well. Of course, who leads industrially? Perhaps in supporting that remains to be seen. Linda, thank you for your call. I was just reading Ignacio Barrón. IBM has just opened a global high-speed rail innovation center, and they opened it in Beijing. This is IBM. I mean, China's huge activity, Mr. Barrón, is making them a center of a lot of cutting-edge innovation when it comes to high-speed rail, I guess.
Sure. Not only IBM, also other important industries, Siemens and other Bombardier, other important multinational companies are manufacturing in China. For example, all the valises used in signaling railways in the world, produced by Siemens, are manufactured in China. I think the explosion of the industry of China is very impressive, and also the technological development. And in this case, it is also possible to consider China as a competitor in the industrial panorama of the world in the coming years.
Yeah.
But for the moment, they are also very, very occupied in themselves because they need to provide to their own country, on a lot of equipments. So the country is under development and in a very, very important rhythm.
High-speed rail has been described as the centerpiece of China's stimulus plan. I mean, it is employing just mountains of people there. Let me get a call from Des Moines, Iowa. Rebecca, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, what do you see?
Yes, I think that we have a choice of either staying stagnant or moving forward. And staying stagnant is just another way of moving backwards. And I believe if we want to compete with major nations like India and China, we need to move forward with this and other initiatives. And furthermore, need to connect what already exists in major cities like Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago to other major cities in the United States. So I'm all in favor of moving forward with this plan.
And what about the money, Rebecca? It's not cheap. China's spending $300 billion. President Obama is proposing $8 billion. I mean, do we have that kind of money, or is that the kind of stimulus spending you'd like to see?
It's the kind of stimulus spending I'd like to see. I think we need to move forward. We need to find ways to move forward and compete with these other nations. Otherwise, we will continue to remain stagnant, and I think that equals moving backwards.
Rebecca, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Let's get another from Montreal, Canada. Josh, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say it's a case of Johnny come lately. I don't think that North America has been investing in infrastructure and planning ahead to create a rail system that's viable. I mean, up in Canada, we've been talking about creating rail links between Toronto, Montreal, Quebec City for decades, and it's never seen the day because politicians say one thing, and then on the other hand, you see more highways being built.
You mean you've been talking about high-speed rail? I thought you had a good rail system in Canada, generally, Josh.
Well, we wanted to emulate the Europeans, and we haven't really created the kind of system they have in Europe. And that, speaking of the Europeans, I spend a lot of time overseas, and one of the great advantages of the high-speed rail system is that you can go from one city to another, for instance, in France, in a shorter time than it would take, for instance, to fly. And that we will never have here in North America. We won't have the rail system competing with the airline industry, which is a huge advantage in Europe, where people prefer to take the train rather than fly or use the car.
Of course, we've got huge distances in Canada and the U.S., a little different in that way, in density and distance, certainly from Europe. Josh, thanks for your call. And let me get one more here from Suzanne in Natick, Massachusetts. Suzanne, you're on the air.
Hello, I just wanted to ask about sort of compatibility between the different cities that they've been planning on linking, because are they trying to be all one system, or is it going to be, you know, one between Detroit, Chicago, and then one, you know, on the East Coast, mm-hmm. and then they're not necessarily going to be compatible?
It's a great question, Robert Puentes. What about it? What's the big picture here? Just little chunks of high speed scattered around the country? Would it ever be economical, let's say across the Great Plains, to have one high speed system? And is it being planned for all these to, you know, be compatible, as Suzanne asked?
Yeah, this is a great question. It actually relates to the question that was asked before. And I think the one thing that we didn't really look at with this was how the rail network is going to interact with the aviation network. And as the caller mentioned, in Europe, it is seamless, and there are these options. If you miss a flight, you can literally hop on a high-speed train and get to your destination. So it's completely integrated, and there's very little thought of doing that here in the U.S. At Brookings, we put out a report last year, and we looked at these metropolitan corridors that are less than 400 miles apart as prime candidates for these high-speed rail investments. The literature shows that this is where rail can really be competitive.
Like where? What are you talking about? The Northeast Corridor and what else, maybe?
Perfect example. L.A. to San Francisco mm-hmm. is one, Las Vegas to Los Angeles, Los Angeles to Phoenix, Dallas, Houston, all these places are less than 400 miles away, Boston, New York.
So those would be the first targets, and you say it's not happening, or it's just not integrated with the rest of the air travel and so on?
It's not integrated. We didn't really look at this with the criteria. The cool thing about the high-speed rail investments was that this wasn't the kind of investments, the way that Washington does business and just spreading the money around by formula.
Mm-hmm.
These were applications that were received from the states. They were judged based on a certain set of criteria, and then the investments or the awards were made based on, the merit that came in from these projects.
But does that mean that they would integrate with air travel or not? And if not, why not?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we have highly siloed transportation program here in this country. We have a Federal Railroad Administration, a Federal Highway Administration, aviation. All these things are kept separate, which is very different from how they do in almost every other industrialized nation. We have to break down those silos.
Ignacio Barrón in Paris, you're coming next week with advice for Americans looking to build out high-speed rail. What's your first piece of advice that you'd give as you begin to talk with your counterparts here?
Excuse me, I cannot...
Your advice for Americans as they look at the big map of this country and begin to move into high-speed rail, you're coming to give advice, I guess. So what's your first piece of advice?
Well, I don't know. I don't know exactly. Mm-hmm. I suppose the ideal first piece in this future system of high speed should be very, very easy. So in an ideal distance in about 200, 300 miles in a very ideal land without not a lot of mountains, not a lot of population areas, with a potential traffic justifying 6, 7, 8 million passengers per year. I think it should be the ideal condition. I don't know if maybe in the Middle East or maybe in California. I think the ideal situation as well, for example, the example of France, from Paris to Lyon, or from Madrid to Barcelona, I think there are ideal cases in which people can realize what are the advantages of high speed, and then they will ask for more.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about high-speed rail all over the world and the new U.S. push to join the game. In a few minutes, we'll look at Toyota's recall on the sudden acceleration problem and what they're doing to try and address that. We've been joined from Paris by Ignacio Barón, high-speed director at the International Union of Railroads. He'll be in the United States next week with folks from around Asia and Europe who are well down the railway on this already. Robert Puentes is with us. He's at Brookings Institution, senior fellow there. We've got lots of response already here online. Here's Dee saying if President Obama were serious, he'd be spending at least as much money as was spent on bailing out the dead car companies. At the very least, rebuild the existing rail system, even if high-speed rail can't be done right away. And here's Ted with a couple of very concrete questions, and I'll put the first one to you, Bob Puentes. He says, what is the energy consumption of rail travel at speeds which are competitive with passenger jets, i.e., you know, up around 200 miles an hour? Bob?
You know, I don't know the answer to that. I know that we've looked at some of the aviation problems and some of the pollution that comes out of airplanes, particularly for the short distances. Is when some of the most emissions occur, these takeoffs and landings.
Mm-hmm.
So making sure that we're looking at these kind of routes as possible, maybe not replacements, but ways to augment this intermetropolitan area travel would be a great idea. We have tremendous congestion in and around the New York metropolitan area airports, and they've tried different solutions for, you know, for addressing some of the congestion in the aviation system. But there's a very obvious example. I think augmenting the rail system is one way that you can really make a dent in some of those congestion problems at the airports.
Mr. Barón in Paris, how about comparing the energy use of air travel versus high-speed rail? Is there a comparison? Is it more efficient?
Yes, of course. I can give you a very, very simple and very representative figure. With a single unit of energy, so 0.1 liter of fuel, you can transport about 20 passenger kilometers. I speak in kilometers, sorry.
Okay, but no problem.
About 20 passenger kilometers in plane and 177 in high-speed train. So, in general, the energy efficiency of railways is much higher than other transport mode. But when you increase the speed, the energy efficiency is still more. So, for example, in European rail companies, operators of high-speed, the cost of the energy is just 2 to 3% of the cost of the production of the service of high-speed. Mm. That means the cost of the energy is really, really low, much lower than people believe.
Let's go to Bill in Newton, Massachusetts. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
We seem to always defer to the government for servicing a plan like this. Why is it that private investment hasn't been discussed? Now, for example, the oil companies or the banks, somebody else mentioned about the bailout. It seems if we had the political, well, everybody knows the benefits. The commercial train system has been very profitable the last 2 years. It's increasing in size. And if we had a stronger lobby or a lobby of any consequence for this, in comparison to pharma, for example, or the bank lobbies, I think that energy and that will, if we can't, you know, if it's not impeded by the political situation, then this would benefit the country immensely.
It'd be great if it would work. But Bill, let us pick it up. I'm glad for the question. Robert Puentes, what about it? Do we wrongly assume that you've got to have giant government investment to make this happen? Is there a possibility you could do something on this scale with private investment? It's hard to picture the interstate highway system, for example, being built that way. But what about it when it comes to high-speed rail?
I think part of it is that we need to change what we mean by these public-private partnerships. I mean, this isn't just turning things over to the private sector and letting them do what they're going to do, but this is about a relationship between what the public sector does and what the private sector does. So the Florida line that the president announced the other day between Tampa and Orlando is a public-private partnership in that you have the Disney Corporation donating land, I believe some money for the station that they're going to build. That's a clear public-private partnership. I think that it's designed to be operated by a private entity as opposed to the Florida Department of Transportation or somebody. So that's a partnership. So it plays out very differently here in this country. But I think that once we get these systems in place, and if they are indeed profitable, and the private sector sees that there is a direct business opportunity here, that they will look for these for investments. But we're just starting out. We can't underestimate just how much more we have to do to get this kind of institutionalized.
Robert Puentes is senior fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. I know we have to let you go. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
We've got a lot of listeners lined up here. Carlo in Union Springs, New York. Carlo, you're on the air. Hello, Carlo.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you see?
Well, I also live in New York City, and I spend a lot of time going from New York to Boston, for example. And the truth is, the existing system, if it were a bit better, a bit more reliable, is right now, center city to center city, not a lot slower than the plane.
Already? Without super high speed, you mean?
Well, if it were better. And I think my frustration is I think the administration needs to sell this a lot better than they did the health care, for example. You look at the time it takes, and you also look at the fact that when you fly, it's all these little increments of sort of stressful time, the taxi, waiting in line, blah, blah, blah. When you get on the train, you have, you know, 2-3 hours of usable time. I think it needs to be sold. I certainly think that the high-speed system down the road has to happen. But we have to start in steps. We have to start giving people an alternative and show them just how it works. And on the other level, as far as what we have, we've invested in the superhighway system in the interstates. I think we've also been doing a lot of experimenting with hybrid diesel and everything. The city buses in New York are all hybrid diesel. I think some very rapid, low-polluting bus system that uses the existing system for the long distances, connecting to a sort of perimeter system when you get to the cities, would be another sort of transition step.
Carlo, I like it. Take a million little steps. Don't be hung up just on waiting for the big high-speed miracle. Well, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Let me get another Todd in Waterbury, Connecticut. Todd, you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? I'll try to be concise here. I've got about 4 points. I've been envisioning maglev trains like through the Northeast Corridor for most of my adult life, you know, connecting D.C. to Boston.
Maglev, very expensive. China has it from Shanghai out to the Shanghai airport, I think 250 miles an hour, way up there.
Right, the cost is what I was trying to address, but I've been postulating like details down to like construction techniques to make it cost effective and like doable. The reason I think that you can't this country can't appropriate the money, whether it's a partnership of private and public, is because of the huge white elephant of the military budget. With annual expenditures of $500 billion a year, it's like 28% of the national budget. And there's no return on your investment there. The absurdity of this couldn't be more exemplified than our expenditures in Afghanistan. And here China is like setting up a copper mine operation, on the backs of our military presence
there. In Afghanistan.
It's really like the military industrial complex is an absurd white elephant that is unsustainable, and we'd be better off like investing in infrastructure where you'd have a return on your investment.
So to take some of that military money and shift it over, Todd, thanks for your call. Ignacio Barón, what about others? One of the questions we're getting here is there a way to have high-speed rail without government subsidy? Now, is there any example around the world of that happening, or is it subsidized by the government in all these places where it's bustling along?
Yeah, in principle, all the developments of high-speed made up today in the world, in Europe and in Asia, has been made 100% by governments, the public funds. But there are some examples, for example, in Taiwan, for example, in the Netherlands, for example, in the new link between Spain and France in the short line, in which a mix financing public and private, it's possible. But in this case, and it will be, but probably this system will be the application in USA, but in this case it's very, very important to precise very accurately what is the percentage to be supported by private investment and what will be the percentage supported by public investment. And in each case, private investment will look for ROI, return of investment, and in this case, public investment will look for a social benefit. And this is very important to appreciate in each case what is the situation. But in general, we cannot say that at least an implication of 50% from the public money is absolutely necessary in this kind of projects.
16,000 miles of high-speed rail going into China by 2020, reported here, an incredible number, $300 billion. In Europe, I'm looking down the list here, Spain, France, Germany, Italy, Holland, Belgium, England, all off on high-speed rail. The U.S. now putting a toe in those waters, and it's fascinating to see how it will develop here, or will not. Time will tell on that one. Ignacio Barón at the International Union of Railroads in Paris, good luck with your visit to the United States next week. We hope you bring some good advice with you. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting. I suppose that our experience to share with you will be very useful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. In a moment, a look at Toyota's massive recall and the new fix. This is On Point. Toyota is shipping out a fix for sticking gas pedals and sudden acceleration, but its epic 8 million vehicle recall is still a story without an end. Congressional hearings will begin later this month. Class action lawsuits are gearing up, and then there are still just the questions about what happened here. Michelle Krebs joins me now from Detroit. She's senior editor at Edmunds, which publishes automotive consumer websites. Michelle Krebs, thanks very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
So we're beginning to hear about this. The lights are on late at night at the Toyota dealerships. What's their answer to the problem that's been all over the headlines in the last week, Michelle?
Well, the answer for cars that are on the road was announced yesterday, and that is a repair to the existing pedal assembly on vehicles to put a shim in there, basically, to prevent wear of the friction materials that are in there. It's very it's actually simple, but it's a little hard to explain. But dealers will be getting the parts soon. They're being trained, and it could be as early as late this week, early next week, that people can start having their vehicles repaired.
8 million vehicles total. Not all of those are. Some of those are just floor mat changes and repairs.
Well, there's two separate recalls. There are. Initially in the U.S., and I'm not counting the numbers outside because I don't know. That's a growing number. In the last year, Toyota recalled 4.2 million vehicles to do a repair on the floor mats were pushing down the gas pedal if certain circumstances were just right. They are changing the length of the pedal, and they are trying to make more room under the pedal so that can't happen. Separate from the sticky throttle remedy that was announced yesterday, although some of the vehicles are covered by both, and what Toyota's goal is that you only bring in your vehicle once if you have both of those recalls and get them both taken care of at the same time.
Now, let's look at that sticky throttle side again. I mean, back in the day, the accelerator pedal was used a cable that was linked right to the engine. Now it's linked to sensors, electronic sensors that tell the engine how hard it's being depressed, I guess. So is it obvious, is it certain that this is about stickiness, not electronics?
Well, Toyota says it's about stickiness in the it has to do with the wear issue right within the pedal assembly. Toyota insists it is not an electronic issue. But many people still believe that. We have, at Edmunds, have no proof of that one way or the other.
When you look at what's just happened here, does it look as though Toyota was way overdue in bringing this out into public, or does it look as if somehow Toyota's gotten itself into a corner where it's getting whacked around on sudden acceleration so heavily right now? I mean, you can look at the statistics. They're not the only automaker who has accelerators that stick sometimes. Are they getting, you know, were they late in coming out, or are they getting treated fairly now?
I think there are a few things at play. One, I think they were late at getting in front of this. And they were not real forthcoming with information, which led to a lot of confusion, a lot of criticism that they were dragging their feet. Two, Toyota is now the world leader, and it's number one in the world in sales. And so whenever that's your number one, there is a target on your back. And thirdly, Toyota has a reputation for bulletproof quality, so this came as a shock to many people that Toyota is having a quality problem. So that's why you get all these factors playing into the huge media play in this.
But I'm looking back at a chart here that shows, this is a chart of complaints of vehicle speed and accelerator pedal control problems. You go back just a couple of years, and it's Ford way up there with this kind of problem. Now
So, you know, this kind of thing is, there are a lot of complaints in that area, the acceleration issues, and a lot of manufacturers have those issues. So nobody should be gloating, because this is an issue that every automaker needs to pay attention to, and they should be taking a lesson from Toyota as to how not to handle it and how to handle it.
I guess guess I'm asking a question which is kind of plainly conspiratorial, and forgive me for that. But is now that Toyota's number one, is there a degree that you see here to which it's being ganged up on or not?
Oh, I think they might say that there's been a lot of piling on. I think that when you're out there saying that you know, the night that it was announced, I was watching the national news, and here the report comes on that Toyota's got these quality problems that can relate to an individual's safety, and then the very next advertisement after that segment was Toyota bragging about its quality.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, that's going to happen.
And was it a voluntary recall, or was it forced by the U.S. government? Are they always forced by the government?
It was a voluntary recall initially, and then last week, in terms of the sticky throttle issue, Toyota issued a stop sale. Now, that's required by law when you know that you have a defect in your product and you do not, at that moment, have a remedy for it. What we will see is the stops, as these vehicles are repaired, then the stop sale will occur. There won't be this one eureka moment when we say, oh, the stop sale's lifted. It's going to be as dealers repair these. But the priority is going to be of individual owners who are out there on the roads with these vehicles.
And on the other side of this, Michelle, do you see this as a game changer in the industry? Ford reported big profits last year. That was a turn of events. Could it be that this will change the ranking, the status of automakers?
Well, certainly, Ford has been gaining on Toyota even before this. Last year, they slashed in. They were beat by Toyota in 2007 for the number two spot, and Ford wants that back. And so this year, they cut the lead, Toyota's lead, by about 100,000 vehicles, which isn't a whole lot in this industry. So they've got a shot at getting back their spot. So in that way, it could be a game changer. But, you know, we never know what's going to happen to the other guy.
Michelle Krebs in Detroit, senior editor for Edmunds. Thank you so much for your report today. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.